I'm Susan Lubay for Women's Focus, and I'm talking to Bryce Pittenger, who is the head of behavioral health for CYFD. Welcome to Women's Focus.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Well, we've all been seeing what is happening with the kids on the border or the kids who are coming across the border, and I thought of that as a federal problem. But of course, if there are kids coming into our state, then you need to worry about it at CYFD. And it turns out that you have been doing various things to deal with the kids, and you know what the situation is there. So let's start by talking about what the situation is.
Okay, well, I would say that the situation is a multi-stakeholder response. So it's state and local faith-based organizations, family-based organizations. And so one of the things that's happening in Las Cruces, for example, is there's about 25 faith-based organizations, churches, that are helping process the children and the families, getting them their basic needs met, finding them a place to stay, and then helping them with their transportation needs to their sponsor. In Deming, it's a very close-knit, tight community. My understanding is that the flow is somewhat abated, but there are at one point between 140 and 400 individuals a day coming through the Deming checkpoint. And so Deming has really pulled together as a community as well and has created initiatives to feed and house and care for, medically care for kids and families that are coming through. One of the calls we had recently with the Las Cruces cohort was about how many people were coming over. And they said they reported about 8,000 individuals since April 1st at that point. And there are kids with families and sometimes unaccompanied minors.
Okay. When you talk about being cared for or taken care of, what do you mean exactly? Do you mean giving them sort of food and clothing, or do you something more substantial than that?
Well, it depends, both. So it's different in each community. But in Las Cruces, what I understand is that they are actually processing the kids and the families. And so while they come through the border, through the checkpoint with Border Patrol Emergency Management, my understanding is doing the initial screen in terms of any identifiable health problems. And then as they're processed by the HHS, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, their needs are being identified. Department of Health is involved in some of those screens. There's a lot of local physicians and prescribers and nurses. So one of the things that we noticed was that we needed to have a response down there to identify kids that were either coming over with a sick parent, and sometimes the parent needed to be cared for in the hospital for a bit. And so it's an unusual way to use foster care, but being able to house those children temporarily in a family while their parent recovers. So that's one of the things that we've seen. And the other thing is the potential for kids coming over that are victims of or potential victims of sex or labor trafficking. And, you know, the issue is not unique to the border. Whenever large groups of people convene, these risks occur. So whether it's the Super Bowl or the state fair or the balloon fiesta, when large groups of people convene, there's a risk of sex trafficking. So that's kind of the way we see it, that because there's such a large portion of folks coming over right now, that there is a risk of sex trafficking. So for instance, one of the things that we've heard from some of our partners is that a child will come across with a family, the family doesn't know a lot about them, and then somebody will get them on the other side. And so they're basically a trafficker's putting them with a family that's not theirs, they're being processed through the border and then taken on the other side. So that's just one example of what can occur. So what we just want to do is be responsive to the need in, you know, in our minds, any child that steps into New Mexico is, you know, a New Mexican child for that moment and for that time, as long as they're there. And honestly, this may be the one and only time that kids that are coming across and possibly being trafficked are being identified before they come into our country and maybe get lost again. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we see that as an opportunity.
Well, what can you do if you are suspect that kids are being trafficked or that there's something that's not on the up and up? It must be hard to step in and take over or something.
It is. So we just play a part, and we play a part, like I said, with federal, local, and state stakeholders. And so what we can do is if Border Patrol or emergency management or Department of Health, anybody screening and processing these children and families identifies a potential risk of trafficking, we've created a protocol where there's a single point of contact for law enforcement through our statewide central intake line. We respond within, 2 to 4 hours with a team that one is an investigator for Child Protective Services, and the other is somebody trained in the commercial sexual exploitation tool that we are using. And so that team responds with local law enforcement or, state police, and an interview is conducted using the tool. And if there's sort of a positive result, meaning that they meet a threshold of being potential victims, then law enforcement at that point can decide to give us custody of that child.
I want to go into the tool later on, but let's go back to some of the kids, because when we've been hearing about them, they've come from even further away than Mexico. They've come through Mexico, either some of them walking and some of them on top of trains and buses and things. So I can't imagine how they could not be sick. It just sounds so hard. And so they must be suffering from malnutrition and other things like that.
And I don't really have firsthand information about that. What I do know is that their journeys are arduous, and this is a real humanitarian crisis. They're, fleeing their countries out of fear for their lives or their children's lives. And so I think that you're probably correct that the kids are tired. They're hungry, their immune systems may be compromised because of the long journey, mm-hmm. and what they've had to endure, and the stress, just the adrenaline and cortisol in their systems that creates this sort of chronic stress. And so then once they, sort of land on this side of the border, on the New Mexican side of the border, our hope is really to be able, best we can, partner with our federal folks and get them what they need and stabilize them, and not just stabilize them and treat their physical conditions or meet their physical needs, but understand that, that this has been really difficult. So how can we create the most trauma-responsive way of identifying what their needs are and linking them to whatever services and supports? And ideally, there could be a system where, they're identified, and then if they are identified as a victim of trafficking and we're not able to attain custody, that, that there's some sort of a system that follows these kids, that knows what happened to them, mm-hmm. that knows their story. And that particular piece is out of my wheelhouse.
Okay. I was going to say, wow. Tell me what it's like to work with the feds. Have you had an instance where you've said, no, this isn't the way we're going to do it, or we're not going to do it your way, we're going to do it our way, or this is the way we do it in New Mexico?
Well, it's tricky, right? Because the way our system works in this state is that law enforcement has to give us custody of kids or through judicial process. And so, it's about, sort of that agreement. And sometimes, people aren't always on the same page, but law enforcement's pretty good at being able to identify risk. I think that with regards to our federal partners and our Homeland Security Emergency Management, they've been pretty good and pretty responsive. They reached out and actually asked us for some help. Mm-hmm. Well, they went through the governor's office, but they asked New Mexico for some help. So I think that tells me that there's at least some individuals there that know what they're seeing when they see these kids come through, and they have concern, real concern about their well-being. I think that this is a trying time for everyone. That makes us all not necessarily at our best in terms of collaborating with stress. We tend to start to think inside the box, not outside the box. So that goes for all of us, state, federal, cities, county, local folks. But that said, you know, the real power that's happening down there are the local people and the community and New Mexico as a state and how we're responding and how we're caring. And, you know, there was a story in the Las Cruces Sun about some bikers that brought down, I think it was like 30,000 meals for people. Mm-hmm. And that was just a beautiful story about, you know, people just deciding to take action and deciding because this is plucking their heartstrings. This means something to them that human beings are coming into the state of New Mexico, and how are we going to care for them? How are we going to respond to them, even if it's just a short term?
That's what I was wondering. How long do they actually spend in New Mexico? We hear about these kids that are kept in various places, but that's mostly in Texas. It's not in New Mexico. So how long do they spend here?
I don't know the exact average on that, but my understanding is they're processed within 24 to 36 hours. So sometimes they're actually getting out to these faith-based church communities very quickly. Other times there's conditions that I'm not aware of specifically that they may be detained longer. But these are not the same kinds of places that Texas has at this point and some of the other states have where they're detained for longer periods of time. It's really just a quick process and let's try to get you out. I think the piece is, you know, I know the governor responded with some transportation options and vans to assist in that. Mm-hmm. I know that other state agencies, including the governor's office, have responded with other sort of basic needs to make the operation go well. And we're all kind of tracking and adjusting as we're learning more and as we're sort of getting deeper into it. We're all kind of tracking and adjusting. And so one of the things that's occurring are these multi-stakeholder group meetings on a weekly basis so that we can all be in touch with each other, so we can all understand what it is that we're doing and how our piece, you know, sort of links the chain.
CYFD usually deals with children in the state, and I think of it in terms of childcare and child protective services sort of all over the state. So what kind of burden or extra caring is this putting on the department? How is this affecting CYFD?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm sure the folks that are on the ground there may have, varying answers. I've been really impressed with, regardless of political beliefs, regardless of individual beliefs, people have come together and decided that this is the directive, this is what's happening. We are going to help these children and families in whatever way we can, but specifically to CYFD and being able to identify, you know, their safety, their physical health needs, like I said, being able to support the children as some of the adults get better in hospitals. Mm-hmm. And so while it may, you know, sort of start to be or become a little bit more of part of everybody's lives there, right now we've dedicated a couple of teams, and folks are at some of the places where the children and families are about 4 hours a day from CYFD. And that way we can kind of survey the situation, talk to kids if we need to, and also be on site if somebody identifies that a child may be a victim of trafficking.
Tell me what the training of the people from CYFD who are on these sites. Are there, I know that you don't have doctors who are working for CYFD, but tell me what the training of the personnel is.
So the social workers, they're either bachelor's or master's level social workers that are investigators. And then the folks within the behavioral health division, my division, are either licensed counselors or licensed social workers. And so those are the folks that they've had. There's a couple of pieces of federal legislation that have increased awareness and accountability for states since 2000, and the first one, the very, very first one. And then again in 2014. 2014. So one of the things that the changes in the 2014 piece of legislation was that we had to do better diligence in child welfare. All states had to create policies, had to create training for their staff, had to create reporting mechanisms, referral to services, and one important piece is to put all missing children in NCMEC, which is the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. That way, if they're trafficked anywhere in the United States, law enforcement can access that information and identify them. So those were really positive changes. So last year, it's been about a year and a half ago, we started rolling out a training. It's about a four-hour training to all of our staff, all protective services workers, probation officers, everybody. And the training really was sort of best practice on understanding and identifying who is at risk for trafficking. And how do you identify that? How do you engage people that are being trafficked when sometimes they don't want to assist in their own release because they don't necessarily think or feel like they're being trafficked. They feel like they're entering into it willingly. So, and then we talk a lot about complex trauma and Stockholm syndrome and how the process happens that a trafficker gains control of a child and maintains control of a child. And then at the very end of that training, we talk a lot about our policies and procedures, how important it is to report and identify. So since we've rolled that out, I think what's happened is that our workers, our social workers, our JPOs, everybody's looking at children now with a little bit of a different eye, where they didn't necessarily see before. You know, we had a case in juvenile probation where a young person was 16, and she got arrested for shoplifting $30 worth of food for her siblings. Oh. So that's a flag, and turns out, you know, later there were other pieces. So I think it's being able to, like, really have new eyes on cases that they currently have or even old cases and, you know, kind of say, oh, this may be happening. So as a result of that training, we've seen increased reporting to our statewide central intake. And through that process, we cross-report to the Attorney General's office as well as local law enforcement, because the Attorney General's office is the lead law enforcement agency. And so if a local law enforcement agency doesn't yet have that experience and training in interviewing a potential sex trafficking victim, they can reach out and help them, you know, sort of steer that investigation. So those now are automated at central intake. We report directly to local law enforcement in the jurisdiction of the victim, as well as the Attorney General's office. And so one of the things that the border sort of escalated for us, we were on the verge of procuring a validated screening instrument for youth. There's only one in the United States. We got it, and it's from West Coast, and shout out to West Coast Clinic from California. But it's a child exploitation tool. It's called SEEIT. And basically what we did at the border was say, okay, let's go ahead and purchase these right now, and let's go ahead and get these folks trained up. So now we have pockets of people in all those areas that have training and experience with this tool and feel comfortable utilizing this tool. And the plan is to roll this out. I just purchased 1,000 licenses. So the plan is to roll this out to law enforcement, to all JPOs, to protective services, to local providers and stakeholders. We've gotten interest from fire departments. We've gotten interest from local law enforcement, from public defenders and children's advocates. And so the hope is that through everything that we do, whether it's overseeing youth shelters here in New Mexico, youth detention centers, all of folks involved with us or at risk, that everybody's utilizing the same tool and able to understand sort of across all of those systems what this trauma responsive identification process looks like.
Good. When you talk about a tool for listeners who aren't involved in these things, you mean questions. It's like a questionnaire.
Exactly. It's like a questionnaire. And with any good questionnaire, you don't sit with the child or the youth with your computer or your paper and stare at your paper and fill out the boxes. You use it as a guide to have a conversation with them. And then you go back and you collect the data. But that is the idea, is that it sort of drives a conversation. And this particular tool was validated in California. And when I say validated, what I mean is for a tool to be like really effective, it needs to have some evidence base behind it to show that it works, to demonstrate that out of the 5 to 8,000 kids that it was used on, that it produced this kind of result. And so, like I said, the See It tool was validated, and we feel like it's both user-friendly, it's super trauma-responsive for kids, and it's really in a language that kids use, and it focuses on engagement. When I was doing a deep dive into what other states were doing, one of the things that I found was that Florida was looking at the screening tool process. Because like I said, all states have to do this in some way, shape, or form. Florida was looking at this process and initially thought, you know, oh, well, this percentage will be, you know, sort of come through as a positive result in the screening tool. And they were, you know, they found that 4% of kids, when asked directly about whether or not they're being sex trafficked, will report. The majority, 96%, do not report. And so the idea is to create a conversation, to engage with that child, to look for the signs, to not go necessarily directly there, but to be able to, you know enough about what the signs are, who is at risk, you know, what sort of the markers are, to be able to ask the right questions for that individual child.
Let's go over again who you plan to be using this in case we have listeners who want to become involved. It's not something that just volunteers or church workers necessarily would do, right? It's somebody with more training than that.
Well, it could be. You don't have to be a clinician to run this tool. So I would open it. I would open it even further than system folks. So CYFD oversees and funds youth shelters. That's my division. And so all of the shelters, it's going to be in their new scope of work for this year to run this particular tool on any homeless child that comes in. All of our detention centers, hopefully, will be a phase in the next couple of years. When I'm talking about these particular groups of children, these are the kids that tend to be exploited, both because of their early traumatic exploitive experiences with adults. They're sort of set up and conditioned, you know, to expect that. And traffickers know what they're looking for. And so they see these vulnerable kids, you know, out on the street, and they absolutely go after them. It's the kids that nobody's really looking out for, that don't have an adult checking on them, you know, every couple hours. It's those kids. And so we're thinking about shelters, detention centers, all of our probation officers, all of our protective services workers, all of our clinicians. We're thinking about providers. I think that there absolutely could be an overlap with some faith-based organizations and children's advocacy organizations. It's really a flexible tool, so anybody can do it. You're absolutely right, need to be what I call deep consent. You have to want to work with this population. You have to want to know the pain. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a requirement. The other requirement is some sort of context and understanding about children, about development, about trauma. Those are the kinds of things that are, you know, a good foundation for this particular tool.
Okay, that brings me to another thought that I have, because for a long time it's been hard to keep workers at CYFD, partly because the work is so hard and they have to deal with so much trauma that they just can't keep doing it. So let's talk about what support you have for this work that you're doing and how the general workers at CYFD are doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an excellent point. And that burnout or vicarious traumatization or secondary stress, whatever you want to call it, is very real in our field. And it's not just child welfare workers. It's anybody, that any systems that sort of encounter abused and neglected kids. So one of the things that we are doing is developing a training and some consultation and support services for our protective services workers, our juvenile probation officers, because what we do see is there's not so much turnover on the juvenile justice side or on the behavioral health side or early childhood. There is a lot of turnover on the protective services side. And so what we do know is that even though we have decreased our vacancy rates and we're filling positions, we just hired 60 new people on the CPS side, which is absolutely fabulous. What we know is that hiring is one thing. Reducing your vacancy rates is one thing. Mm-hmm. Retaining employees, retaining good employees, and supporting them so they will be able to sit in the fire and keep coming back and have what they need is a little bit more difficult. So under the previous administration, we started doing some initiatives like 3 days of administrative leave if you've been through a traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. And so a director of any division can, you know, award that at any request. And actually, there's not a limit to how many of those you can have for a worker. So if a worker, you know, is in a situation where a child dies or, you know, has just, you know, uncovered, you know, something horrific, they can actually request administrative leave. We also have, like, I think it's 6 sessions, and that was upped. I think it used to just be 3. We have 6 sessions with the AP, you know, that's fully covered so they can actually go to counseling. And then we have some contracts with some providers, community providers that come in and debrief after a significant incident. So with the whole office. So I've been a part of that. I've helped with that, but I've also been a part of that when I've been in pain and when we've lost kids together in an office. And so those things we need to probably do more of, but those are the things that really start to make a difference in terms of how somebody can handle the stress.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so it sounds like you're optimistic about how this is going to work.
I am optimistic. I think, you know, there's a lot of unknowns, but when you have the will, which we seem to have in this state, to be able to respond in a humanitarian way to whatever it is that's happening, including what's happening at the border, that is a huge piece for any just state government employee like myself to have the collective will, the people in power, to be able to provide, you know, what's needed. That shores this all up, to be honest.
Okay. I've been talking to Bryce Pittenger, who is head of behavioral health for CYFD. Thank you for letting us know what's happening in New Mexico. It sounds like it's a really New Mexican response to a federal problem, but that we're sort of not being pushed around by the feds.
That's correct. I don't think that MLG would be pushed around by the feds.
Oh, really? Okay. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Susan.